Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. Welcome to a week of History Hack ranting, and ranting is what we do best. So we lost our shit when the Supreme Court did their thing. I really lost my shit. I don't usually do politics on Twitter and I went loony. But then we regained it somewhat and we decided, what can we do as a history podcast to stick our oar in within a frame of reference that we operate in? And so Zach decided that we were going to do a whole week that showed people just how damn hard it was for women to get anywhere in this world, so that we could hold it up as a frame of reference as to why we're all so pissed off now, didn't you, Zach?
There's a basic moral to this story. If you want to understand life, pick up a bloody book and do some reading.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to demonstrate over the course of this week. We're going to look at lots of different angles on women's rights. Yes, we are going to tackle the abortion thing. We're going to look at social housing. We're going to look at women before the courts. We're going to look at contraception through time. We're going to look at how women have had to fight for pretty much every single bloody thing that men have taken for granted since day one. And if you don't like it, then piss off somewhere else is my really adult suggestion to anybody who's going, oh, I don't like the politics being inserted into my history. It's history. Politics has been embedded in it since the dawn of time. And if you're going to turn around and say that you're not interested in the history of half of the global population, this ain't the podcast for you, buddy. It's been nice knowing you. Adios.
Do you feel better now?
It's been a week of
that was many like things. A hold my beer moment, wasn't it? Our guest now looks terrified. Our guest today is Elaine Vice. We're thrilled to have her because she's here and we're going to talk about the fight for female suffrage. That is women getting a vote. She's an award-winning journalist and author. She's written books such as Fruits of Victory, The Women's Land Army and The Great War. And I'm so having her back to talk about that. And The Women's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote as well. So, Elaine, welcome.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Listening to your accent, I think we should ask all our guests this week, Zach. What was your reaction to the Supreme Court? Although that name should be taken off of them. They can be the court in charge. There's nothing supreme about them right now.
No, there is not. My reaction was anger and dismay, and trying to think how we can overcome this. It is a terrible decision, both historically dishonest and legally questionable. And of course, I would say morally wrong. So
I'd go with morally bankrupt as well, especially from people like, oh, don't even get me started on Clarence. Let's not do this. Let's stick to the history. Let's talk about the history, because we can demonstrate, can't we, just the sheer force of will that it took for women to get the vote. And how I think this week will show, Zach, as well, that they can try and take women's rights from them and ownership of women's bodies from them. But I mean, they're going to have a hard job, aren't they?
They are going to have a hard job, and rightly so, because when you understand the scale of the fight to get these rights in the first place, you realise, if it was ever not apparent to you, that women are, in my humble opinion, women are just better. Men try hard to be their equals. Women win. And for once, Alex isn't twisting my arm to make that statement.
It's just for those who don't know, Zach raised by a very fierce single mother. No mm-hmm. dad in the picture. So, he's going to go to bat for us big time, aren't you?
And I think there are plenty others who will as well. But sadly, the inverted commas powers that be seem to think that it's okay to tell a woman what to do with their own body. And until such time as that changes, certainly I will be doing what I can to make people realise the historical precedents and realise what a fucking stupid idea this was in the first place. Apologies, rant over. Elaine, let's focus on you because you're our guest and you're here to enlighten us as opposed to listen to me get angry and ranty and sweary. So let's talk about precedent. I mean, the first thing I want to say is thank you for joining us because this book really blew up. I think it's fair to say that it went down incredibly well. I think on the front cover, you've got a testimonial from Hillary Clinton, no less. Is that right? So, yes. You know, the powers that be in the world of US politics looked on this and went, yes, this was a timely book and it was really well done. So we're going to strip it right back to the beginning, if we may. What's the earliest evidence we have of calls for female suffrage, specifically within the USA?
Well, I think it's fair to say that women have noticed that they were not getting a fair shake in whatever power structure they were in from the dawn of time, as you said. So it's not like women woke up in the middle of the 19th century and said, oh my goodness, we don't have the rights that men have. They knew it for a long, long time. And they knew it in every nation, not just the United States. And I should say that, of course, the women's rights and women's suffrage, the vote, being only one part of that umbrella of rights that women claim, equal to male rights. So this was a very much a worldwide movement. It was not just in the United States. It was paired most directly with Great Britain. And they were sort of sibling movements and causes. The women communicated with each other and visited one another and learned from one another and had conferences together. And so you see the American and the British movement for women's rights and women's suffrage go in tandem. So in America, there's a famous quotation by Abigail Adams at the dawn of the creation of the United States, first the colonies, then the states. And her husband, John Adams, is at the Constitutional Convention, and she's home running the entire farm and the family and all the business of the Adams family. And she writes to John and says, remember the ladies. Remember that when you're creating this new nation, that you have women's rights and interests in mind. Of course, he ignores it. And so what we have is a democracy that is founded on the idea of we the people and government by and for the people. We've kicked out your monarchy and we are going to have a government of citizens, except half of the citizens will not be counted, not to mention the enslaved populations who will not be counted, or the indigenous populations who will not be counted. So we begin to have a rather narrow view of who citizens are, what their rights are, and who can have a voice in this government by the people. We often, what's so interesting is, as in Great Britain, the abolition movement, the movement to abolish chattel slavery, human bondage, becomes a sort of catalyst for other movements and other ideas about human dignity. And so there again was a worldwide anti-slave movement because the slave trade was not just in the United States, of course, it was in Great Britain. It was in many, many, many countries who profited from enslaving others. And so what happens is women get involved in this. They are deeply, it's a moral crusade. It's a civic crusade. How can you enslave fellow human beings? And they become part of this abolition movement in Great Britain and here and elsewhere. But when they go to these meetings, there's a wonderful story, which is accurate, of the 1840 worldwide anti-slavery movement. This is the international conference of those who oppose and are actively working in their own nations to abolish slavery. And there are, in America, there are women delegates who are chosen to go, who are very active in the movement. And two of them are especially interesting to us. One is Lucretia Mott, who is a Quaker woman from Philadelphia, who is a meeting facilitator in her church, who is a very fearless, active abolitionist. And she is chosen by her meeting to represent them at this meeting. And she has full credentials and is a bona fide delegate. And she comes to the meeting and her documents are questioned. They say, "You're a woman. You can't be a full delegate. No, we don't have women who are representatives here." And she is banished up to the balcony of the hall where this was being held in London. I think I mentioned the name of the hall in the book, but I've forgotten it. And the women are put behind a curtain and they are allowed to listen, but not participate. And there's this whole day debate about whether women should be able to have their voices heard. Because at that time in so-called civilized society, a woman's voice was not to be heard. A woman was not supposed to speak for an audience of men and women. That was considered, get this word, promiscuous. So Lucretia Mott, this revered, fierce mother of five, lion of a woman, is told to go basically up to the back behind a curtain and not be heard. Another woman is sent to the balcony. She is not an official delegate. Her husband is. She's a newlywed. She's on her honeymoon. And part of that is they go to London for this meeting. Her name is Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And she's 25 years old. And she's up in the balcony with Lucretia Mott, who's a generation older, much more experienced, much more politically savvy. And they're both steaming up there. They're indignant. They're angry. They're apoplectic. And they become friends and they walk around London and they say, you know, we've got to do something. We've got to have a meeting just of women and you know, talk about all the things that we're not allowed to do. And so they talk about this. They go home. They communicate. They write letters. It's about 8 years of letters. Elizabeth Stanton goes on to have something like five children in this time span. And Lucretia Mott is also extremely busy. And finally, in the summer of 1848, when the entire world is going through revolutions and rebellions and civil wars, Lucretia Mott comes up to the town in upstate New York where Elizabeth Cady Stanton and several other very active abolition women live. And this area was kind of known as a hotbed of radical thinking. And they're having tea after church on Sunday. And they start talking and saying, you know, we should have that meeting. We should just have a meeting of women to express our anger and our frustration and how our government is failing us. And so they decide to have a meeting in the next 10 days, I mean, less than a fortnight. And they organize it and they, Elizabeth Cady Stanton writes all the materials and they pull it off. And this is called the Seneca Falls Convention. It's the first women's rights convention in America. About 300 people come to their surprise. They couldn't believe they just put a little like advertisement in the newspaper, in the local newspaper. It's pretty much a local and regional affair because you know, you didn't have a lot of time to think about it. And there she creates this amazing document called the Declaration of Sentiments. And it's based on the Declaration of Independence, same cadence, same wording, it's a takeoff on it. And it talks about all the rights women do not have. It even talks about equal pay for equal work. And the idea of what women's rights were not, they had no right to property. The property belonged to their father or their husbands, no right to bring civil suit in a court of law, no right to their children. Their husbands owned their children. They were not allowed in universities. They were not allowed into professions. And so she makes this list of these, and then she comes up with resolutions to ameliorate them, to solve them. And this document, which of course the whole meeting was roundly denounced in the press and was called, you know, the insurrection of the women was the headline in New York papers.
How very dead I have an opinion, right?
Right, exactly. How dare they speak up? And this is looked at, even though it's certainly not the only meeting of women, but it's the only one dedicated to the idea of women's rights. It's not just an offshoot of a temperance movement, which of course is all also going on in both of our countries at that time, the idea of abolishing the sale of liquor, which women were very involved with, both as a moral issue, but also as a domestic violence issue. This was the only way they could protect themselves if the laws did not protect them. And so there are women meeting in temperance events, at abolition events, but this is the first one that's just about women's rights. And it spawns many women's rights conventions in the actually weeks, months, and years to come.
I want to take it back, if I may, to something that you said right at the start about Abigail Adams. And she says to John, look, don't forget half the population. and he promptly does. It sounds like a dumb question, but why? You know, is because you've got this point in history where America has the opportunity to really pause and think. And it is, in on paper at least, it is, you know, this suggestion, all men are created equal and all the rest of it, that is embedded in the fabric of what the US seeks to be. As it starts out on this new path, having broken away from the United Kingdom, it has the potential to be so much more than it actually does by being kind of Western European in its attitudes towards women. Why is that decision taken? Is there just too much influence coming from Western Europe? Is it just too early for people to be seriously thinking about women as active political players? Is it the fact that you actually in the US, because you haven't had the monarchical system where women have had influence in court in different kinds of ways, there isn't that same cultural precedent? What's the reasoning behind it?
It's because men run the government. it seems like, you know, as you say, how can you deny half of the population of the world their rights and get away with it? And this seems to been a good gig for the patriarch. And I think one of the interesting things, which is coming out in modern scholarly research about the suffrage movement, is that the women founders of the movement, and there's you know, a group of women who become active very quickly, studied some of the indigenous tribes in the Northeast whose own form of tribal government gave enormous power and influence and voice to the women in the tribe. And they visit there, they talk to them, they study it. And there is now the understanding that they took some of the ideas of the suffrage and women's rights movement, suffrage being only one of the women's rights being claimed, from these indigenous people who had figured out a better way on their own. So when you say, was there Western influence? Yes, of course. You know, we still rely on British common law today. So we are not totally broken free. Many of the men who were considered our founders were either the had been born in Europe or first generation, first or second. So the tie is very strong, but also it doesn't take much to claim power. How do you claim power? And that's one of the questions that these movements are asking. Abolition asks it. Women's suffrage asks it. The civil rights movement in the U.S. in the mid 20th century asks it. Who claims power, and how illegitimate is that claim?
I'm really interested to ask you, we've heard a couple of names already, but what are the backgrounds of the leading advocates in the early stages of this process, and what kind of reception do they get? I'm guessing not a very encouraging one.
No. It's interesting that the women founders in the mid 1840s, 1850s, and 60s tend to be middle or upper middle class women who are better educated than most women. They have had through family wealth or through a liberal parents or just happenstance or force of will, they have gotten themselves fine educations, as fine as a woman can get, because she can't really avail herself of higher education in most places. And so they are educated, they are worldly, they have, some of them have traveled, many of them are already politically active. And now that's not to say that we don't have the factory girls, the shop girl, the shop women, the immigrant woman, and also very important in America to understand that Black women were very, very keen, understood completely how important this vote would be, the free Black women who were allowed to free movement. Of course, the slaves had no say in, but the free Black women in the North and in the West were very, very active in trying to join the movement, organize, bring support from their communities. And that was a tough road to hoe for all women. How were they? So there is sometimes a criticism that this was a middle-class white women's movement. And to a great extent it was, but that doesn't mean that, because they had the means to do this, they had the means, they did not have to be for the most part domestic servants, they were not, they had help for their children. I mean, they had the means, just as today that there are certain women who have the means to be politically active, and others who care just as passionately but do not. So it is founded by middle-class white women, but immediately is joined by women of every class and every race and religion. There are Latina leaders in the West. There are Asian American women in the West. There are, it becomes a very wide movement. How are they treated? Well, I'll just say this, that in the mid to late 19th century, when Susan B. Anthony, another name that everyone kind of knows, one of the famous founders and quite an extraordinary woman, who would go up, they traveled from little town to little town, giving speeches, trying to change hearts and minds, because they knew they had to change attitudes before they could change the law. And that's something that we have to understand today. That has to proceed. What Susan Anthony's mantra was: organize, educate, agitate. You had to do all those things. And she used to say that she could mark the progress of the movement by the nature of the projectiles that were thrown at her. So when she no longer got rotten eggs thrown with her, and just plain eggs, well, that was progress. When it wasn't rotten tomatoes and just regular old vegetables, then that was clearly progress. They were demonized, they were denounced, they were belittled, they were told they were, whores, traitors, loose women, Bolsheviks, when that time comes, they are accused of everything. And they are going to ruin the moral fabric of society. They're going to abandon their families. All these incredible epithets are aimed at them. And they have to just keep going.
And this is exactly kind of the point of what we were trying to achieve with this week of shows, to make people realize we're going to use a technical history hack term here, just what a shit show it's been to achieve any kind of, you know, just that simple ability to determine who governs you. And this is the kind of response. I do want to talk about methods of campaigning. You kind of led us quite neatly into it there, because in the UK, we see the suffragette and the suffragist divide. And for those who can't remember the distinction between the two, the suffragette are the more, inverted commas, militant ones, the more, inverted commas, violent ones. Varying forms of that. The way to remember it, as you're saying the word suffragette, say it aggressively and imagine you're slapping a policeman in the face. Not that I advocate doing that today, I hasten to add, unless you desperately want to see the inside of a cell. Suffragists, more kind of about, like you were saying there, you know, the change of hearts and minds. Is there an equivalent in the US? Is there that suffragette, suffragist discussion, first of all? But also, do you then see that tension being played out between sort of the, almost like a splintering of the movement as they campaign in different ways?
Oh, absolutely. There's several splinterings. And I'm very glad you bring up the suffragist versus suffragette distinction. We certainly have to deal with it a great deal. I have to, whenever I'm traveling, give a talk, I have to give the, explain this. Because it's an interesting, as that term comes over to the U.S., even the militant wing, which develops in the first and second decade of the 20th century in America, and it's through women who actually cut their teeth, got their apprenticeship in Great Britain with the Pankhursts. So someone like Alice Paul and Lucy Byrne are young graduate students, and they get caught up in the suffrage movement here at the beginning of the 20th century, and they learn all the more militant confrontational tactics. They bring it home to America. And so people naturally, well, the press calls them suffragettes because they are of this more militant stripe, even though they never actually destroy property or do some of the more militant things that were done in the UK. But what's interesting about that is the word suffragette was made up by a journalist in London in 1906 to make fun of the militant suffragists. He uses the diminutive from the French, et, to make them seem, you know, kind of silly and frivolous. And the UK, the Pankhurst suffragettes take that name and say, okay, you're going to call us that? We'll call ourselves that. They own it, as we'd say today. They
plant bombs in Westminster Abbey. We'll call ourselves by the silly name you thought up for us.
That's right. But in America, the more militant, more radical, they aren't really militant, they're radical, National Women's Party, which is the Alice Paul wing of the movement, say, no, we're not going to use that silly term made up by some man trying to make fun of us. So we are not going to be called suffragettes. We're going to be called suffragists. So both sides are, both wings take keep the name of suffragist. But of course, the press loves suffragette. It's easier to say. It's more fun. It's a little, word for it being a little more sparkly. And so what happens is that that word sticks, and people still call American suffrage advocates suffragettes, and we have to correct it. But that split first appears in the U.S. Actually right after the Civil War, when women who had worked for the abolition of slavery, worked for the freeing of the slaves and for to get the vote for the slaves, are assumed that all the disenfranchised classes will get it, that women, white women and black women, will get the vote along with black men who've been disenfranchised. And they're really sorely, bitterly disappointed when they're told, no, America can't take two big reforms at once. We can't do the freed slaves and we can and women at the same time. You're just going to have to wait.
Oh, please. And, multitask, people, multitask. But men can't, can they?
No, they can't. Sort of attention deficit.
Yeah.
And so, again, we see something that's done in history a great deal, which is the powers that be pit two disenfranchised, powerless groups against one another and say only one of you are going to get the prize and go fight it out. And that's what happens. And it splits allies like Frederick Douglass, who was an ardent, called himself a women's rights man. And he truly, truly, truly was. And he supported female suffrage and he supported the suffrage movement for all of his life. And he has to then go to his women colleagues and say, you know, black men need this for our very lives. We're being killed in the Reconstruction violence. And, you know, we have to have this. And I know you're disappointed and the women's hour will come. I mean, that's where the title of my book comes from. The women's hour will come, but you will have to wait. And so some of the women suffragists say, okay, we'll just have to support this. We'll wait, we'll work on the state level because we have a federalist system. It's a little more complicated. We don't have just parliament to worry about. We have the state legislatures. And at the time there's a growing number of states, but we have to deal with the legislatures because election law is state-based in the US. So each state can make their own rules. So there were states in which women could vote and states in which they couldn't, very much like reproductive rights today. And that's something that is part of the US system that we have to contend with. And so it splits for a generation, for 25 years. It splits among those who supported the 14th and 15th Amendments, which gave the vote to black men, but not black women. They were just as angry and not white women. And those who would not support it, and those who did. And so there's the National Association of Women Suffrage and the American Association of Women Suffrage. And they work at not together. And then finally they merge and become the National American, what a name, Association of Women Suffrage in 1890. And then they go forward. Then there's another split in 1913 when Alice Paul comes back with all these great ideas for juicing up the movement, which has been kind of dormant, and says, look, we can't do the same things. We've got to be more confrontational. We're not going to beg anymore. We're not going to ask politely. We're not going to be ladylike. We're going to be rude. We're going to be disruptive. We're going to demand what we want and make the men understand there are consequences if they don't support this. And so they pick up the White House. They do things that have never been done before. They pick up the White House, they stand silently on the steps of the Senate. They're doing more publicly confrontational things. And the other suffragists are just as busy, but they are working more in the system very, very adroitly. And it takes both of those to finally pressure Congress to pass a federal amendment, which will supersede all the state amendments. You know, they were also working in the states. Remember, it takes 72 years from the time that the women at the Seneca Falls Convention first sign on to a demand for the vote, which was considered just totally outrageous at the time, to the time of the 19th Amendment in 1920, gives by the law of the land women the right to vote. But then, of course, we'll understand that this does not cover everyone. It does on paper, but because of the federalist system, because the states make rules and laws for who's eligible to vote, it will be state law that will deprive mostly Black women and men of their right to vote until, you know, the Civil Rights era and the Voting Rights Act 1965 in America. And now we see an erosion of that Voting Rights Act too.
I think you've mentioned the 19th Amendment, which does finally go through in 1920. But there's a concern, isn't there, beforehand, that this thing isn't going to get over the line. It's not cut and dried.
Oh, no, it's not. And again, because this is an American story, race becomes a big part of it. It was fascinating to me in doing research for this book. Who opposed women's suffrage? You know, Zach asked that question. Like, why couldn't you think bigger, think better? Who opposed this? Why would they oppose having their own mothers and sisters and wives have a say in government? And what was so fascinating to me is to discover who the opponents were. And they change a bit over time. But what's so interesting to me is, A, the corporate interests who were against the idea of women having a voice in government at the state or the federal level.
Well, this is like the gun lobbies all over, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
People making money off of a situation don't want it to change.
Exactly. And here it wasn't the gun manufacturers. It was clothing manufacturers who were afraid that if women could vote, they would outlaw child labor and cheap women's labor. And those industries depended on cheap labor to make a profit. So it was going to be bad for their bottom line. They didn't want it. The liquor industry, women had been very prominent in the suffrage movement, as we saw back in the 19th century. And prohibition in America, that very strange experiment, was already law. It went into effect in 1919 as the 18th Amendment, just preceding the 19th. And so it was in effect. So you say, well, why the liquor interests, the bartenders, liquor manufacturers, the hotels, the restaurants, why are they all against women's suffrage? Because they are afraid that if women have a voice, more of a voice in government, they'll want the prohibition rules enforced. And if they can keep women away, well, maybe they won't be enforced. And then there's the racial aspect. Especially, you know, I write about the last battle for the last state to ratify, to make the 19th Amendment enter the Constitution as law. And it's a Southern state, it's Tennessee. And so you see all the vitriol come out. Most of the Southern states actually reject, do not ratify the 19th Amendment. They say no. 3/4 of the states have to approve it for it to become law. And the Southern states are all saying no. And the main reason they're saying no is because it will allow Black women to vote. And the 15th Amendment back in 1870 had already given Black men the vote, but that had been undermined by state laws, by Jim Crow laws. And so the Southern states had figured out how to keep Black men from voting, very successful at that, with intimidation and violence, and, you know, grandfather clauses and literacy tests and things like that. But they were afraid that it might be unseemly to do these things to women. Now, they got over their reluctance very quickly. And what we see in the 40 years coming after the 19th Amendment until the Voting Rights Act is that in the southern states, Black men and women will be prohibited from voting in many, many cases. So those are the opponents, and those are the what the suffragists have to face. And they have to build alliances with not only racist and misogynistic congressmen, of course, all of Congress is male at the time. Just about 99.9% of state legislators are male. And they have to convince them to give up power, to give up half of their electoral power. And that's not easy, but they do it.
Kai, I'm going to rabbit hole just for a moment, if I may, and go back to something that you were saying about that pitting of Black male suffrage versus female suffrage, and pitting those two movements against each other. And this is a question that comes from ignorance, of not being well-versed in the history of the US democratic movement. But it does strike me that there's almost a sort of a suckering in going on there, because we know about the nature of the Jim Crow laws, separate and equal doctrine, and the way in which nominally Black men may have had the right to vote, but in fact there was a whole apparatus that was deliberately, willfully making it incredibly difficult for Black men to access the vote. Was that all part of the same kind of insidious aim? You know, so we're going to make these two sides fight it out, and then on top of that, let's make this even more difficult, or is it more organic than that?
Well, the original fight over the what's called the Reconstruction Amendments, so right after the Civil War, the 13th Amendment outlaws slavery. Britain already had a law like that for quite a few years. The next that comes out of Congress are the 14th and 15th Amendments. 14th, very important. From there, it's our due process precedents and our citizenship precedents that are at issue again today. But that's an extraordinarily broad and fundamental amendment to our Constitution. And that was not sort of explicit enough to guarantee that the newly emancipated Black citizens would be allowed to vote. And so the 15th Amendment explicitly says that no one shall be denied the right to vote on account of race or previous servitude. So it is specifically written for the freed Black slave. But it's also the 14th Amendment put the word male into the Constitution for the first time. It says male citizens. And so put together, that means, well, okay, Black men can have the vote, but Black women cannot. And that occurs right after the Civil War. Then during Reconstruction, Black men really do vote, supported by the Black women, organized, you know, very much by Black women in the communities, and they do vote. And so we see this enormous resurgence of elected officials, and there are Black men sent to Congress. There are Black men in the state legislatures. There are Black men who become mayors in the South. And all this becomes frightening to the white male power structure. And so by the 1870s, Reconstruction has been, you know, sort of kneecapped, and it goes back to the status quo, and the Jim Crow laws begin to be promulgated, the Black laws, as they're called, putting these restrictions on making it much more difficult, and literally throwing the elected Black elected representatives out of the chambers. And so we see that, you know, once it becomes obvious that yes, our Black citizens want to participate and want to be able to be part of self-government, then the powers that be get nervous and say, okay, so now what can we do? And they, at the state level, abetted by a complicit Congress, shall I say, they do nothing to help. They make this, what we call Jim Crow laws of legalized segregation, legalized degradation, legalized voter suppression. And so the suffragists are in the last phase of the movement are dealing with that too. And that becomes, as we see what happens in Nashville, Tennessee, in the account I give in my book, race becomes a huge issue. And it's used by the suffragists when politically expedient, because they do have to try to appease racist legislators. But it's also used even more effectively and diabolically by the anti-suffrage forces, who use it as a weapon, who threaten that if the 19th Amendment is allowed to be ratified, that Black women will take over the nation. I mean, there's just crazy, as we call them, conspiracy theories going around. And so race becomes an issue in suffrage from the beginning to the end. And of course, continues on.
Elaine, we've kind of talked already about how you feel about what happened in the Supreme Court, but looking at the future and your knowledge of the past with respect to that, what do you think the future holds in a time when women now have fewer rights in some states that they did have a couple of months ago?
Well, I'd like to say that women are going to rise up and take to the streets and picket the White House, though it's not the White House that we have to picket, mm-hmm. the Supreme Court, make our arguments and make our power known. That doesn't seem to be happening at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think we're still kind of shocked. I think we're still dispirited, depressed. We also have elections coming up this fall that are really important. And I think people are concentrating on that rather than on public protest. And that's fine. That is really where the power lies. And that's where we have to put our energies right now. I think that in order, especially in the abortion or forced birth issues, taking away bodily autonomy from women, I think, frankly, we have to make it clear that this sort of decision making, if you're going to take bodily autonomy from women, well, maybe it has to be taken from men. I think we need to make that very clear and painful, because I think this is, you can talk about some religions who believe that abortion is a sin. My religion does not. I'm not forcing anyone to have an abortion. You cannot force me to have a forced birth. So I think we also need to know that conception doesn't happen immaculately, that men are involved, men are responsible. And, there are interesting, probably blue sky going to go nowhere discussions happening in social media I've seen where, okay, well, then maybe part of these laws should be that men have to put up, that the father of the child has to put up a $350,000 bond to make sure that mother has the wherewithal to raise this child. The slogan of pro-life, which I never use, because it really has nothing to do with this question, because in America, we do not have universal health care. We do not have available higher education at a decent price. We do not have childcare. We do not have parental leave, we don't have all the things needed to support new life. And so until we get serious about this, that part of it, I don't want to hear about pro-life or the slogan of pro-life. So as you can tell, I'm still quite angry. but it's not, you know, for us, it's a whole range of issues. Again, voting rights being eroded, a big concern. Our foundation of our democracy being attacked. I think people, you know, women are very angry about this, especially rolling it back after 50 years, making one of the things that I find really frightening, among all the others, or diabolical about this, is that if in some states now, a woman who seeks an abortion or has an abortion, terminates a pregnancy, is really all it is committing a felony. And the providers of that medical procedure would be felons.
It's the idea that the person that drives them to the state line, yes, could be done for aiding murder.
And also the medical professionals and the person who drives them, they would be felons and they would lose the right to vote.
I think there's also significant kind of fear that, as you're kind of pointing to there, it doesn't end here, potentially. You know, in the past, we have sort of looked at shows like The Handmaid's Tale and almost scoffed, you know, well, that would never realistically happen. Yeah. And yet, an end point like that always has to start with an initial step. And this was a more than significant initial step, it feels, which is why we at History Hack sat down, had an adult conversation and decided that, notwithstanding my rant earlier, that this matters. This is far too important as a moment in history for us to not start to take this issue seriously and set it within a serious historical context. And Elaine, you've done that beautifully for us today. Thank you so much for joining us. Folks, this book matters. Go and read it. The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We will do all the usual things in terms of making sure you can find the links to go and get it. Please do get it. I'm not even going to do my thing about Jeff Bezos and Amazon and Rockefeller and all the rest of it. Just go get the book, get the damn book. If you need to give Jeff Bezos your profits, go do that.
Actually, okay. There's a better way. There's bookshop.org. It's a nonprofit that shares proceeds with your independent bookstore.
Which is exactly what we use. So folks, there you go. I haven't even prepped our interviewee to plug that for us. But Elaine, thank you so much for joining us. This has been really enlightening.
It was a pleasure.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support and here's to your next great book.